welcome to the Research Culture Uncovered podcast, where in every episode we explore what is research culture and what should it be. You'll hear thoughts and opinions from a range of contributors to help you change research culture into what you want it to be.
Hello, welcome to another episode of the Research Culture Uncovered podcast. My name is Nick Shepherd. I'm Open Research Advisor based here in Research Services at the University of Leeds. And my episodes on the podcast tend to focus on open research. So today I'm very pleased to be joined by my colleague and fellow Open Research Advisor, Kikuchukwu Oluwanyi. So welcome, Kikuchukwu, and look forward to speaking to you.
Thank you, Nick. It's really lovely to be here.
And did I get your name right then? Because I suppose we should say I've practiced that a few times, haven't we? And I've got I can say your first name, but the surname.
I think you did amazing with both of them. So.
And, well, before we start talking, perhaps just to... Because we've been working together for a little over a year now.
That's right.
All aspects of open research. And recently we did, for example, an editathon, or a translation event, didn't we, for yes. Wikipedia. And your first language is Igbo?
Yes, it is.
So you're from Nigeria?
Yes, I am. I'm from Delta State.
Okay.
From Anyocha North, local government of Delta State. So that's referred to the Igbo-speaking part of Delta State, where we speak a dialect of Igbo called Enuani.
Right, well, I won't try to say that word, but
okay.
but it was interesting, wasn't it? Because we've been doing a lot of work here that we'll talk about on the podcast at another time on Wikimedia and Wikipedia, and that included translating Wikipedia into other languages. And you being an Igbo speaker, you did some translation of an article into Igbo. Just tell us quickly about your experience of that and how you found that.
My experience was quite interesting. I found that the translation itself, the automated translation, was quite accurate, except for the tonations and the signs and symbols that should be in the words. But as an Igbo speaker, it was really, really exciting to see that there were barely any corrections to be made. I would say that that's really pleasant for Central Igbo, but it did inspire me to want my own Wikipedia page for the Enuani speakers so that we could preserve our own dialect, which is significantly different from the general Igbo language.
Yeah, well, obviously that is something we talk about. And as I say, I've got Lucy, our Wikimedian, coming on the podcast soon, so we'll talk about that in a bit more detail. But just finally, before we do move on to the UK and work, we weren't totally sure of the word for snail, as I recall. And you phoned your dad.
I did call my dad during the session because I was excited to know what we call it. And he said it's Iloma, and that channeled my passion to actually wanting to create that Wikipedia page. So it's absolutely useful.
Yeah. So say one more time.
It's called Iloma.
So that's Igbo for snail. So that's great.
Oh, that's Enuani for snail.
Oh, that's Enuani.
Yes.
So what's Igbo for snail?
I've actually forgotten the Igbo word. I have to check that later.
Okay, but that's the... Yeah, anyway.
Yeah, that's our own dialect for snail, which is significantly different from the original.
Okay, well, we'll move on, I think, to talking about open research, but thank you for that. Perhaps tell us a little bit about UKRN, the UK Reproducibility Network. What's their sort of background and what's...
So the UK Reproducibility Network has a consortium of 24 members who are interested in accelerating the uptake of open research practices across the institutions. And the University of Leeds has joined the program since February 2024. So right now we are working towards, instituting the Train the Trainer program within the university. And this is a program where we deliver high quality training to a couple of participants, a minimum of 10 participants, who will then go on to provide training to at least 15 colleagues each. Mm-hmm. And we are hoping to attain a goal of about 180 individuals trained in open research practices across the institution.
Mm-hmm. So at the moment, that's what we're talking about today, to try and encourage colleagues to come along and to volunteer to join that Train the Trainer program. Perhaps tell us a little bit about who it's designed for and who you're looking for to take part in this program.
We're really excited because the program accommodates both professional services colleagues as well as researchers, so it's quite flexible.
And are the career researchers or more established researchers?
Well, early career researchers, PIs, research fellows, but not PhDs.
Not PhDs. And so can you tell us a bit about when you're hoping we'll actually start with this and what the time commitment will be?
We do have our first training taking place on 25th September and the last one later in December. And we will have a couple of these sessions running from time to time. These trainings can run from 1 to 3 days, depending on what training it is. So there is no particular time or date set in stone. They can redo these trainings over and over again. So you could have one day online and another one, you know, in person.
And who delivers it then? It's not Leeds, is it? It's colleagues from the UK Reproducibility Network?
We are looking to collaborate more with our colleagues in Leeds, but for now, it is partners that we are collaborating with as the UKRN Open Research Programme, who are funded by Research England, nationally and internationally.
Okay, so you've already mentioned, I think, you're looking to fill about 10 spaces, hopefully, if we can. So how should people, if they are interested, how should they get involved, get in touch with you?
Well, yes, first they can get in touch with me through my email address, which I think will be linked to this. And they can also get in touch with Professor Daryl O'Connor.
Yeah, so Daryl O'Connor is our institutional lead, isn't he,
for the
UK Reproducibility Network. So he's also someone that they can speak to, and if they've got any questions they can again speak to you or to Daryl as well about this as well. And this isn't actually the first time we've run this program, is it? I don't think.
No, this will be our second cohort. Yes.
Tell us a little bit about the first cohort. How did that go?
The first cohort had about 8 members, and the institution was unfunded at the time, so it was a little bit of a challenge. However, all the courses are free this time around, so we're expecting more engagement, more involvement from everyone. We think it will be a huge success.
It might be it might be worth just you and I sort of recapping why this program was initiated and what we think the value of this is, because we've spoken a lot, haven't we? You and I go out and train colleagues around open research, but we're generalists. We don't know the disciplinary details necessarily. So the idea of this, I think, is to bring in disciplinary experts.
It is.
And to liaise with them to understand what the barriers and benefits to open research are in specific disciplines. Is that fair to say?
Yes, I would say that is absolutely correct. In our journey as open research advisors, we found that we could do things in a discipline-specific manner, or we could do things in a methodology-specific manner. And I think that these trainings encourage that methodology-specific movement that we are trying to achieve at the moment. Some of these courses, you know, could appeal more to STEM, or it could appeal to some colleagues who are in arts and humanities and have a crossover in STEM. So it's a really interesting way to enable collaboration between colleagues who don't even relate with each other on a daily basis, and to also get creative with your work. We also have the strategic objective, which we've been working towards, embedding open research in the institution. And I think amongst all of our initiatives, this is a really great way to collaborate on campus and outside of the campus to enable greater knowledge exchange.
Yeah. And that first cohort, did anything to sort of report back on that? Did they enjoy doing it, the colleagues that took part in that?
I would say yes. You know, when it comes to open research, a lot of people do have the opinion that this is very psychology-centric. Mm. However, we have had good reports coming back from other disciplines that it is useful outside of psychology and STEM. And we also are looking forward to hearing more, because in the first place, we were only able to do the reproducibility lecture. But I am hoping that this particular suit of trainings will be more inclusive than the last one.
And so it's really just to say it's very wide-ranging. I think, you know, we want colleagues, don't we, from a range of disciplines and a range of career stages. And hopefully to be interdisciplinary for colleagues to be able to work together.
Yes, I do hope so.
And what happens once those people are trained up, then do they get some sort of recognition for that?
They are given certificates upon completion. So that means you do have to complete the courses and you do have to go on to train other people. So you'll be provided a certificate upon your conclusion and you'll be given the title of Open Research Training Lead.
Well, that's great. Thank you, Kukuchukwu. So I suppose to give you the final word, what would you say to colleagues to encourage them to come and join this program?
I would say please join the program and share your views with us on how we can make this more inclusive and how we can make open research practices better applicable to you if you think that there are limitations, because that's what we're doing in our role. We're trying to learn and also make things better. So yes, please join.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So following on from my conversation with Kukuchukwu, I thought it'd be really interesting to talk to an academic colleague. So I'm here today now with Dr. Scott McLaughlin, who's Associate Professor in Composition and Music Technology based in, well, the School of Music, obviously, and that's in within the Faculty of Arts, Humanities and Cultures. So hello, Scott, and welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Nick. Thanks for having me. Nice to be here.
So as I say, just for following on from the conversation I had with Kukuchukwu. So at the moment, we're just trying to promote the next cohort of the UKON Train the Trainer programme. And you were part of that first cohort, I think.
Yeah, I've been doing that this year. It's been really interesting to talk about this stuff with people across different faculties and with yourselves, of course, getting that bigger picture.
Because one of the conversation I had with Kukuchukwu was that historically, a lot of the UKON work, the UK Reproducibility Network sort of angle, it's tended to focus on, you know, it's come from psychology and focused on social sciences, etc. But you're a musician. And I mean, perhaps you can tell us a little bit, first of all, about your sort of academic background and your work before we get into sort of what open research means in that context.
Yeah, absolutely. So I currently work and teach and research in a school of music. I don't come from quite the same kind of classical music background as some, but not all, but many of my colleagues. So I was originally kind of like a shoegaze guitarist, experimental guitarist. And from there, I became a composer, working in all sorts of genres, doing a fairly niche kind of experimental music. I went back to university, did a PhD in that, and that avenue took me into what we now mostly refer to as practice research, which is essentially, and it doesn't have to be in the arts, it's a clinical thing as well, it pops up all over the place, but it's essentially where the key methodology, the key way of doing the research is through the practice itself. So in my case, the process of doing composition, or sometimes the process of performing and collaborating, etc., those are all the research process. And because of that, that means I'm also then involved a lot with non-traditional submission of outputs, that kind of thing, which is a really interesting space to be in. And again, it's really interesting to see how other disciplines approach this. So with something like the Train the Trainer, then I saw this as a really interesting opportunity to look at questions of things like reproducibility and open research, and both how is it done in other disciplines, like the disciplines that really started these conversations, and then how does that come into my area, which is performing arts, humanities? How does it look for us?
Yeah, that concept of reproducibility is an interesting one. I mean, it's even in the name of the UK Reproducibility Network, and I think I haven't actually seen them myself, I don't think, but Kukuchukwu's more involved with Train the Trainer, but there were some sort of off the shelf resources, I think, that UKON provided, which from conversations with you, I think, did sort of focus on reproducibility and that sort of side of things, which didn't really, you didn't relate to, and it didn't sort of make that much sense in the context of your practice research.
Well, this is why I wanted to get into this. As it happens, before Train the Trainer, I was involved with the UK's PRAG network, which is the Practice Research Advisory Group. They did a session with the UK Reproducibility Network a couple of years ago, where we sat down and said, well, what does reproducibility mean across psychology and the arts? And that was quite interesting to be able to bounce these things around with these with people in psychology. But certainly when I first looked with some colleagues at the train the trainer process, it's interesting that slippage between open research and the very psychology based empirical data based problem. So there's quite rightly, there's a lot of work being done in psychology and other empirical disciplines to try and deal with reproducibility, the reproducibility crisis, all of these issues that they've had kind of exploding in the last 10 to 20 years. What we tried to do then was take this word reproducibility and see, well, what does this mean in the arts? Because we don't, particularly in something like practice as a composer, I'm not doing the same kind of objective knowledge gathering that is happening in an empirical study. We have a much more subjective approach, and because of that, the idea of reproducibility in psychology, it doesn't map one-to-one across to us. But at the same time, it's a really interesting conversation to say, well, what does rigor mean for us when we're not doing these kinds of provable science STEM-based ways of doing research? So it's about looking at how research has been done in the humanities and in the performing arts, and just seeing how do these things map to try and get a universal understanding of what these things mean in research. So, sorry, to go back to your original question, yes, the original UKRN things were very focused on this reproducibility questions and making sure that methodologies and protocols and data were being done well. And we had a really fascinating time looking at this slide deck and saying, well, what things here can we just take and use as is in the humanities and performing arts? And what things do we need to actually have some conversations in our disciplines to say, well, what does this mean? Is this useful for us? Is this meaningful? Do we need a different version of this? And it's also then mapping it back up to more of your area, taking that quite small focused idea of reproducibility and going back up to what does it mean for open research in general. So I think for us, it's more about thinking bigger than train the trainer, in that it's more about thinking about what does open research mean in the humanities, that it's not just open monographs and open access and things like that. There's a whole bunch of other things.
Yeah, and it was quite interesting as well. Am I right in thinking there was another colleague of yours, another Scott Bannister, was he also on train the trainer? So we had an interesting discussion. So one of the challenges, again, I just discussed a little bit with Kikuchukwu, is, you know, I've been thinking about, you know, we're generalists and we don't know necessarily the issues, and that's related to a specific discipline. So we thought, you know, do we try and break it down on a disciplinary level? But that doesn't necessarily work. So your colleague Scott Bannister, I think, is a musician, but he's into the psychology of music. So for him, this all did make sense. That was his sort of research, did map onto the sort of reproducibility side of things, whereas for you it didn't, even though you're both in the same school.
And this is a classic institutional issue, where just because you have a school of music doesn't mean that everyone in that school is doing the same type of research methodologies, etc. And while it's naive of me maybe to say that this is a bigger thing in music than maybe other humanities areas, I'm sure it isn't actually. This is just me speaking from my own area. But certainly within music, you can have people who do very traditional humanities work in archives, looking at old documents and translation, etc. And you have people like Scott who are trained in the empirical methodologies of psychology. They just do that methodology in the context of music. So something as universal as music, you know, we have music computational scientists, we have music data wranglers, we have performers. The entire gamut of epistemic and knowledge possibilities exist within our discipline. So that was really interesting from a train the trainer point of view, because me and Scott had a lot of interesting conversations about our quite different perspectives on what could be done here. And what was useful is then trying to go to our entire faculty of historians and linguists and fine artists and dramaturgs and media people, etc., and say, where are the pockets where people are doing this empirical research? And they certainly exist. We've got corpus analysts in English and things like that who are absolutely empirical researchers, but they sit inside a humanities area. So it really exposes that this isn't just a STEM versus other things thing at all, that it really is horses for courses and trying to find what's the best fit for different places.
Yeah, and I think that for me, and perhaps for you as well, as you've just been saying, that, you know, that's the really interesting aspect, or an interesting aspect of open research, is it does bring different disciplinary perspectives together in really interesting ways, and you learn from others in that way. And it just reminded me, actually, there was an interesting serendipity, wasn't there, with was some of your a composition of yours called The Garden of Forking Paths. Is that right?
That's an entire project with 10 or 15 compositions in it. But yeah.
But that actually means something else in statistics and open research that I sort of flagged to you. I don't know if you remember. So which you'd had no knowledge of, I don't think, that I'd read it's quite, you know, any colleagues out there that know about open research will be familiar with that concept of Garden of Forking Paths. It's to do with different decisions through statistic analyses and that kind of thing. So it's just quite a nice sort of serendipity with in a totally different context that you'd happen to use the same title. And I think it comes from a Borges story, does it? I think that as well, is it?
Yeah, that there is a Louis Borges story that takes that as well. It is one of those nice overarching concepts that can be applied in all sorts of interesting ways to things. But I think it is exactly as you say in this, it's interesting to think about it in that way, that there isn't one open research, there isn't one reproducibility, there's principles. And then, in fact, the open research thing that's really interesting is how it spawns a whole bunch of questions when you see what another discipline calls open research, and then you look at your own discipline and say, oh, actually, we've been doing something like that all along. We just weren't calling it that. And sometimes it throws up really sticky problems, like particularly for someone like me, a composer, or say a novelist or a poet, who's also then dealing with external things like publication, non-academic publications, so they might have a novel out. How do you make open research out of something that's under a strict copyright in a commercial context? Yeah. What part of it do you make open? From a practice research point of view, it throws up all sorts of interesting questions about how much of the process do you expose to other researchers. Composers are traditionally quite reticent to talk about their compositional processes, but if you're talking about knowledge generation, you really have to. The onus is on you as the artist and researcher to put stuff out there. But the question is, how much? Do I film every day of myself and put 3 terabytes of video out that no one can sift through? Do I carefully curate something? It's a really interesting set of conversations.
Yeah, and then through this, and obviously I'll circle back around to Train the Trainer, but we were then obviously talking Kikuchukwu and I, and had a chat with you, and is he the Pro Dean for Research and Innovation, Matthew Chahern, in the Faculty of Arts, Humanities and Cultures, because we've been working with the Dorries, and again they're trying to learn this stuff, and as you've already mentioned, there's a whole range of stuff over there, so we're still sort of thinking about that, aren't we? So, you know, there's sort of getting people up to speed with the infrastructure, you know, Symplectic and the White Rose Repository and ORCIDs and Scopus and all that kind of stuff. So we're doing a lot of work around that. There is then, as you've already said, this corpus linguistics, or there's people actually working with large data sets, social scientists that perhaps the UKRN off-the-shelf stuff does work for. So I think you're going to do some training along those lines, aren't you, for colleagues in the faculty?
Yeah. We're trying to find those pockets of people for whom the existing standalone training is already going to really be helpful for them. And then we need to branch out and have other conversations about how we can be useful. And I think as well, maybe the question for you partly is, where are the kind of sticks and carrots in all of this? Are there places in the next few years where UKRI or REF or someone is going to turn around and say, oh, this has to be open research, and suddenly our disciplines are going to have to think about that? So it's useful to try and get ahead of the curve a little on these things.
Yeah, so that's kind of where we're starting, isn't it, in the faculty with Matthew and with the Dorries, the Directors of Research and Innovation in the faculty, and then we Kikuchukwu, myself and you continue to liaise perhaps on a workshop for the Faculty Research An Innovation Committee. I think that was the suggestion, wasn't it, to consider some of the, you know, broader possibilities of open research in the faculty as a whole. Thinking about diverse research outputs, you've already referred to that, and I did actually speak to Sam Hetrick on the podcast very recently, and I think you and I are both planning on going to the Festival of the Hidden Ref, aren't we, in early October, so that's part of this discussion as well, the sort of broad range of research outputs. And then I think the other thing that we wanted to talk about was some of the more difficult areas of open research in the arts and humanities, sort of, I don't know, copyright issues. I mean, what sort of things might we need to think about there, do you think?
It's a difficult conversation, that one. And in some ways we're starting to dip into that with the existing things around open research strictures from REF, et cetera, around certain types of outputs having to be open research. And the monograph, certainly in the humanities, the monograph question has been really back and forth. I mean, there's it's a conversation partly outside of our control. It's lots of publishers outside academia, etc. There's all sorts of questions going on there about how that would be done. That's the question that's kind of live at the moment. And that, as you say, spits out also then into a lot of different types of practitioners. I, as a composer, for example, am not concerned with copyright because I self-publish everything. And in my universe, most composers self-publish. There's a few that have publishing houses, but they're fairly small. Whereas I think for poets and authors, it's much more common to have a publisher of some sort and for them to have some sort of commercial relationship with the thing. So there's questions about, well, how much can we make open? How do we make things open? What is it? How do we get research insights out if we can't put the full artifact itself out there, the novel or whatever? So those are questions. And I think those are the tip of the iceberg, though. There's all sorts of questions from, say archive scholars wondering about, well, how do I make open the process of me walking into a dusty room and, you know, taking tweezers out and looking at a 500-year-old manuscript? What am I not doing that's open, or what things need to be thought about more? I think as someone who's absolutely not in that area, I'm curious to know what kind of conversations have already happened around that. Maybe they already think that they're doing something that is as open as it can be. Maybe there's room for something else. I simply don't know. But this is my point. I think there's a lot of conversations happening in small scales, but not a lot of national conversation that we can all tap into and connect.
What's just a quick plug, I guess, for the project that you've just got funding for, I think, with Westminster, is it Enact? Will that look at some of these issues?
Yeah. So this is a project to develop a national digital repository for practice research. It's going to take a while. We have some funding now from the AHRC to proceed with the kind of basic development, the proof of concept version, and to do a lot of co-design with community and talk to different disciplines about what this repository would be useful for. We've already established the need through the Sparkle project and the Pure Voices project and the Prague UK report in 21. There's a lot of need for this, but the question is, how do we actually implement it in a way that the community really wants to be involved with? So from an open research point of view, again, there's a certain amount of carrot and stick aspect to it. We think very much that practice research is a useful starting point here because we're already dealing with a lot of these issues around NTOs and trying to articulate things outside of text, etc. So trying to deal with making open a lot of things that are traditionally closed in artistic practices. So that's the open research question is constantly live for us. How it will actually play out is another question. But I think the team at Westminster who are leading this, they've done some really excellent work already on a schema for how this can be represented in a repository. So, you know, we're opening the doors. And then once those doors are open, then we have to look at users, talk to people who actually use this, do trials, do sandpits, see what it will actually get used for and what problems and conversations that throws up.
No, that's great. Thanks, Scott. I'm just a little conscious of the time. I could talk to you for a lot longer about this stuff. But just to sort of circle back to Train the Trainer, I mean, by the time this goes out, we're on quite a tight time scale to recruit the next cohort. So I think there'll be another week after this does go out. So I mean, would you encourage colleagues to get involved? And, you know, what would your message be to colleagues that are interested in learning about more about open research in their own disciplines and, you know, getting involved with this Train the Trainer programme?
Absolutely. Like I said, I think it's a space that I already was dipping into. So I think anyone interested in how open research might be done in their disciplines or already know a little bit about how it's working for them in their disciplines, but want to see how it's done in other disciplines. Yeah, it's a really great program and process because it opens you up to all of these discussions. And I think the more people we have from disciplines that are less obviously engaged with this, again, psychology, for example, is very immediately engaged with this. It's a very live conversation for them. It's a less live conversation in the humanities outside of open monographs, etc. But that's why we need more people involved in the conversation, more people talking to you and Kikuchoku, etc., and just having this conversation spill out into disciplines more.
That's great. No, well, thank you very much for your time, Scott, and I'll let you get on and look forward to working with you in the future.
Thanks for chatting, Nick. Really enjoyed it. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Research Culture Uncovered podcast. Please subscribe so you never miss out on our brand new episodes. And if you're enjoying the discussions, give us some love by dropping a 5-star rating and written review, as it helps other research culturists find us. And please share with a friend and show them how to subscribe. Thanks for listening, and here's to you and your research culture.